When we hear about creatures disappearing from the wild, the concept itself can get a bit abstract, because it's one thing to hear about spotted owl numbers dropping, for example, but how many spotted owls do you see on a regular basis anyway? A creature perhaps closer to your experience is the monarch butterfly, fluttering around with golden black wings, and it turns out also in greatly reduced numbers. A recent report from the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation shows monarchs in their California wintering grounds down by 75% over the last two decades. The report is called State of the Monarch Butterfly Overwintering Sites in California. Of five authors, Emma Pelton is listed first. She is conservation biologist in the Endangered Species Program at the Xerces Society, and she's our guest on The Exchange today. Emma, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. This involves Xerces, I notice, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Tell us about how the project got started.
Sure. We actually have been in contact with Fish and Wildlife Service for the region that covers coastal California, and the lead for that is Samantha Markham, who works for Fish and Wildlife, and she was really interested in getting more involved in overwintering sites. And so, as we know, the monarch has been declining, and so the overwintering sites along coastal California are often kind of at this nexus of human use of the coast, and the butterflies also need these trees. And so really thinking about trying to assess what we know and what we don't know about the California overwintering population and what steps we need to take to protect the butterfly at that life stage.
I think the term is self-explanatory, but could you explain a little bit about the migratory motions of the monarch butterfly and why they need overwintering sites?
Yeah, so the migration that people most often think of is the massive migration in central Mexico, where butterflies are spread out across North America during the breeding season, so kind of March through August, September. And then they show up in massive numbers in central Mexico. But what people often don't know is that there's a similar migration that happens on the West Coast, where a lot of monarchs in the western U.S. go to the coast of California, and they're more spread out. So they're all the way up to Marin County, and then they go down actually into Baja, into Mexico. And they're spread out at little sites all along the coast. So it's kind of a similar phenomenon that's happening in California as is happening in Mexico, just with fewer numbers.
So are the monarchs on the West Coast the same species, same everything as the monarchs that do the central Mexico migration?
Yeah, same everything. All the genetic analyses have shown that it's one big population. And actually really interesting tagging work by a couple different organizations, including the Southwest Monarch Study based in Arizona, have shown that if you tag butterflies in parts of the Southwest, some of them end up in California and some of them end up in Mexico. So there's actually probably butterflies that go either direction in the West.
Oh, some mixing of the populations then for sure.
Yeah.
And the tagging sounds interesting. I often wonder, we talked about this before, I think, but how do you tag a monarch butterfly and not change its flight patterns greatly?
I feel like that's everyone's question. Actually, I think how it got started was the Urquharts were a couple that in the 70s, actually through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they were ones that were based in Canada, and they kind of invented this stickering program, kind of inspired by the produce stickers you get on your apples. So it's a really tiny, really sticky little sticker that just sits on the back wing of the monarch and has a number and a phone number to call, typically. And so if you sight a butterfly with a sticker, hopefully you've got your binoculars out and you can read that number and you can call it in. Somebody then knows the path that it took.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. So this is how you know about the populations mingling.
Mm-hmm.
So in looking at this report, the state of the monarch butterfly overwintering sites in California, I mean, you had some suspicions, I'm sure. I mean, there probably were other preliminary sets of numbers that you had available that had already been compiled somewhere to indicate what the fate of the monarchs was, I'm thinking.
Yeah, we actually, Xerces has been a leader of the Western Monarch Thanksgiving Count, which is a citizen science effort that was started by three biologists back in the late 90s because they were concerned at that point that numbers seemed to have been going down at some of their larger monarch sites. And so we've been tracking the monarch butterfly population in California since 1997 every year, and it's solely a volunteer-run program. It's people spread out and go to as many sites as they can. And so because every year we have different numbers of volunteers, we can't always say with certainty whether or not the population has gone up or down in a single year just because you have, you know, people covering one site one year and no one goes to that site the next year. And so this project really allowed us to take a look at all of that data in a more concentrated way and really think about it and kind of use some fancy statistics to really come up with a better idea of the decline instead of kind of a really rough estimate that we get each year.
Was the Western Monarch Thanksgiving count inspired, at least in part, by the Audubon Society's Christmas bird count?
Exactly. We kind of stole their holiday theme. We decided to bump it up a little bit earlier and not compete with their Christmas bird count. But yeah, and because monarchs typically are arriving at their overwintering sites by early November, Thanksgiving is a really nice time to get an idea at once they've settled in of how many are there.
And plus, as families gather and they need to walk off some of the turkey and pie.
Exactly. We try and usually have it be it's a three-week-long period, so we try to have it fall so there are three weekends. So if you don't make it out that Thanksgiving weekend, you've got two other chances.
Emma Pelton is talking about monarch butterflies with us here on the Jefferson Exchange. She is a conservation biologist with the Xerces Society based in Portland. She is the lead author of a report called State of the Monarch Butterfly Overwintering Sites in California, lead finding down 75% over two decades. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions, comments, and observations of your own, perhaps, about monarch butterflies, welcome here at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Emma, what are some of the pressures upon monarch butterfly populations?
Yeah, that has been really well studied in the East, and in the West we have a lot more questions. In the East we know that milkweed, the decline of milkweed, especially in our agricultural and our grasslands in the upper Midwest due to changes in our agricultural practices. We use a lot of Roundup Ready crops, glyphosate resistant, genetically modified corn and soy, cotton. And so because of that repeated spraying of herbicides in those crop fields, and kind of inadvertent effect of that was that a lot of milkweed was really killed over time in the last couple decades in the upper Midwest. So we've seen a huge decline of milkweed, and that has been directly linked to declines of monarch butterflies in the East because monarchs, their larvae, rely on milkweed as the only food they can eat when they're caterpillars. And in the West, we don't have that same pattern of agriculture and that change. However, we still think that changes in agricultural practices, especially in the Central Valley of California, kind of a key area monarchs need to move through, could really be one of the pressures on monarchs.
Is there any deliberate eradication of milkweed for any particular reason, or is it just that it seems to be a collateral damage when trying to eliminate other weeds?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I know that, most of the ag practices are probably inadvertent. People aren't necessarily targeting milkweed. It's not generally considered a major agricultural weed. But I think that there are some conflicts with rangeland use. Milkweed can be poisonous, along with a lot of other plants, can be poisonous to livestock. So generally, cows and sheep will avoid eating it, but if they're stocked at really high densities, they can be poisoned or killed by milkweed if they eat enough of it. So there are more kind of anecdotal level reports that people might be targeting milkweed eradication if it conflicts with grazing.
I've heard it said that milkweed is toxic to everything but butterflies. Is that true?
Yeah, there's a few exceptions. There's actually quite a few native bees, beetles, that use milkweed and use the nectar. But in general, because they have that sticky latex, which gives it its name when you peel a leaf open, that has some protective plant chemicals that are called cardioglycosides, and they actually affect how the heart functions. And so if a bird eats a monarch butterfly, typically if it eats enough of it, it actually will cause the bird to vomit because it affects its heart.
Wow.
Pretty cool science.
It truly is. Is there anything else, though, that larvae eat on their way to becoming monarch butterflies? Is it just milkweed?
It's just milkweed. There are a few little exceptions. Sometimes monarch females can get tricked and use a plant that looks like milkweed called dogbane, but you can tell it apart because it has a red stem. Milkweed always has a green stem, no matter what species of milkweed you're looking at. So occasionally a female will lay eggs, but typically those caterpillars can't survive. They can't make it all the way to an adult.
How long do monarchs live between the caterpillar phase and the butterfly phase?
The adults, when it's the summer, they're going to just live a couple weeks. They're really out there to make the next generation, and so they're just going to live a couple weeks, and then that last generation in the West that goes back to California, that can live up to 9 months. So a monarch being born right around now, it's becoming an adult, might make it all the way until about next March.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so less than a year for sure. And how far do they travel as flying adults? I mean, I'm curious to know about the range of the migration.
Sure. So in the eastern U.S., you know, some of these monarchs have been found, you know, coming all the way from Canada, from kind of the southern edge of Canada, and they make it to Mexico. So it's thousands of miles. And it was often viewed as the longest insect migration in the world that we knew of, but it recently got knocked down to number two. Some great work with migratory dragonflies showed that dragonflies are actually crossing the ocean. So they beat monarchs, but monarchs can still fly pretty far.
Well, that's a bunch of distance anyway, for sure. We're talking to Emma Pelton at the Xerces Society. She's a conservation biologist and the lead author of a study called State of the Monarch Butterfly Overwintering Sites in California. Major finding, the butterflies are down about 75%, 74% is the exact figure they use, over the last two decades. You can join us on the exchange to talk about the findings and what to do with them. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So most of the information in this report is based upon that Western Monarch Thanksgiving count?
Correct. Yeah, that's really the bulk of the information that we have.
How reliable is that count? We're talking citizen volunteers that do the counting, right?
Yeah, we have actually a really core, dedicated group that have been going out sometimes for decades, and we're really thankful to have some really great regional coordinators, because I'm based in Portland. We've got some people that are actually on the ground who live in the California coastal area, and so they can really motivate volunteers and get them out and get them training. And it takes a little bit of practice. It's really great if you're going to go out with somebody who's been doing it for a while, because you've got to kind of get your search image down, and you know what might look like five butterflies to you is actually 25 butterflies, because you've got to kind of visualize how they cluster really tightly. So kind of having somebody to bounce those numbers off of is really helpful.
That was part of the question, was how you, first of all, how you identify separate butterflies, but also how you identify individual butterflies. This isn't like the bird count of the Audubon Society, where you got different birds to look at. It's, you're looking for monarch butterflies and monarch butterflies alone. How distinctive are they that you can say that I've seen this one before?
Sure. Yeah, we tell people to go early in the morning, because as it warms up, if it gets above about 55 degrees and if it's sunny, the butterflies will start to fly, which is really kind of a magical experience if you're out there and you've got swirling butterflies around you, but pretty hard to get a good count. So we ask that people go early in the morning or when it's cooler, and they're still in these little clusters. And so you just kind of sit there with your binoculars. You've got to be pretty patient. You try and start to pick out individuals. And they're typically only, they're less than 20 feet off the ground, so they're not that far away that they're too difficult to count.
You've been looking at the numbers over the years. They're always available to you, I guess, but when you look at the decline from, it looks like 1997 numbers, how big a surprise was this?
I think this was a much larger decline than we had hoped it would be. I think that by actually looking, we took an average of the first 5 years of the count for each of the sites that had been monitored regularly. And so by really getting that kind of early number, and we could compare it to the last 5 years of the count, it was really striking how big of a difference that was. Because if you look from any 1 year to the next, you know, some sites go up, some sites go down. And that's really typical of a lot of insects, because they're really weather dependent. And so a good year, they might go up. And so it's kind of hard to see, I think, the forest for the trees when you're kind of looking from 1 year to the next. And so by kind of doing this big scale comparison, I think we were a little bit surprised with how steep that decline has been.
But you are trying to make sure that it's the same sites that you count every year.
Yeah, and that's why, actually, if you look at kind of our graph that we typically publish each year that shows the number of monarchs, you'd notice that there's a pretty sharp decline in the first 2 years, but then it kind of looks like it's evened out. So I think that can be a little deceptive, but I think what our caveat would be is that we've had more and more volunteer interest, so we're getting more people out there on the ground, which kind of makes the numbers appear steady. But if you kind of account for that, if you just look at sites that we're regularly monitoring, that's where that decline becomes more obvious.
In fact, you brought it up. I'm looking at the graph in front of me from page 7 of the report. If you throw out that first year, the decline would not seem quite as precipitous.
It doesn't look that bad, yeah. And that, I think, you know, it's kind of one of these tricky things. I know that in Mexico, World Wildlife Fund always, they announce the numbers that they have each year. And I think that people get really excited when it's a high year because they think it means that there's been a recovery. This past fall had the highest number of monarchs in Mexico in the past 5 years. However, those are kind of ideal weather conditions. That was a really good year. And so if you look at those graphs over time, it's the same trend. You have about, the average estimate is about an 80% decline in Mexico. It's a really similar story when you account for kind of varying levels of effort and fluctuations over time. There's still a pretty steep decline.
So does that mean, Emma, that you're seeing other numbers that go along with this, like perhaps 74% of the habitat gone or 74% of the milkweed gone? Are there correlations that come into this report as well?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Some of the other factors besides just changes in agriculture and our increased reliance on herbicides that are really killing milkweed, some of the other factors that have really changed over the same period have been an uptick in our use of insecticides that are neonicotinoids. So this is a group of insecticides that has also become really heavily relied on in agriculture, and they've been shown to have both lethal, they kill monarchs, and they can also have kind of sublethal effects, which we've often heard about with honeybees, where a pesticide might not kill a bee, but it might disorient it and make it less fit. So that's kind of another correlation that's been shown to be possibly leading to this decline of monarchs is our use of insecticides.
We're talking to Emma Pelton of the Xerces Society about the decline of monarch butterflies on the West Coast, the population that moves in our neck of the woods, showing about a 74% decline over the last 20 years. We're talking 1997 to 2015, which actually is 19 years, I guess. But you can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. The neonicotinoids, wasn't there a time when these were thought of as the good pesticides?
Yeah, and I think it just depends on what your perspective is. Neonicotinoids are really wonderful in the fact that they have very low toxicity for humans and for birds and for mammals. And so they were kind of heralded as this replacement for a lot of our really toxic pesticides like our organophosphates. So in that sense, they've really been a success. But it's taken us a little bit, as it often does when something new comes on the market and seems like the silver bullet, that there are all of these darker sides to its effects, and that's that it's not selective and it can kill pretty much anything that's an invertebrate. So all of our beneficial insects, so our bees, our pollinators, the wasps we rely on for pest control, it's also killing a lot of these other creatures.
So you're killing the stuff that you want to have around in addition to the stuff you don't want around.
Yeah, it's not very selective.
So you do rank monarch overwintering sites in California, Pismo Beach in San Luis Obispo County being number one. What makes it so significant, and what does the ranking of the sites set up for you? What are you trying to do with that information?
Yeah, we thought a lot about how to kind of create this ranking of sites, and so we decided that what we thought were kind of the most important factors were how steeply the monarch population has declined, indicating that the site is maybe in need of help. It's maybe in need of protection. It's in need of restoration. But also if it has a strong showing of monarchs still. So having sites that now host no monarchs are not maybe the sites that we should really put our energy towards. So Pismo Beach is a really great example where they still have a lot of monarchs. They have over 20,000 monarchs most years, which is actually one of our biggest sites in the state. But they've also undergone a severe decline. So we're kind of trying to point them out, saying that could be a really important site to think about preserving. Because as you can see from our totals, they actually represent over 10% of the entire population of monarchs ends up at Pismo Beach.
10%, wow, that's a big bunch. Does it help at all that people are beginning to develop these monarch way stations? We've had people on talking about developing those. They're trying to make good, comfy places for monarchs to hang out for a while.
Yeah, I think that the movement for people to make monarch way stations and to plant milkweed and to plant nectar are wonderful. And we know that we've lost milkweed. I guess the other piece of this is native nectar plants. a lot of these agricultural practices that have hurt milkweed are also affecting nectar sources, and monarchs as adults don't eat milkweed. They rely on the nectar of flowers, and so as you have fewer and fewer nectar resources available, that affects their ability to have energy to make the migration successfully. And so this is the really inspiring piece of monarch conservation. I think while we need kind of larger changes in agriculture and how we protect monarch overwintering sites, there's a lot an individual can do by planting a little way station that helps monarchs on their journey.
Can you buy the seeds or the plants at a nursery?
Yeah, I think that the one caveat we have, that it's important to ask the right questions when you go to a nursery or you go to Home Depot or you go to the farmer's market. A lot of growers use neonicotinoid pesticides or other insecticides to keep their plants pest-free, but these are the same chemicals that can hurt monarchs. And so we even know that sometimes milkweed that's grown commercially can have pesticide residues in it. So I think making sure that you ask those questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Emma, just before we go, when you look at certain parts of the graph of the Western Monarch Thanksgiving count, I mean, by comparison to 2009, for example, 2015 looks great. Do you draw any comfort from that part of the graph?
I think that's that piece that's really hard to know if that's a true uptick or if that's just we actually had our highest volunteer effort last year. So it could just be that we've got more people who are caring about monarchs and are out there counting them.
Okay. Well, we will see, I guess, with the next Western Monarch Thanksgiving survey. But 2012 through 2015, four straight years, increases in the total monarchs reported. But over the course of the total chart from 2015 back to 1997, a 74% decline as reported here. The report is called State of the Monarch Butterfly Overwintering Sites in California. Emma Pelton at the Xerces Society is the lead author of 5, and she's been our guest on The Exchange today. Emma, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
All right. It's been a pleasure.